In this and my last lecture, I'm talking about the relationship between fiction and the world. And in case people weren't here last week or have forgotten everything I said, I'll just say something very quickly about what I said last week. So in my first lecture, I defended this claim that works of fiction, paradigmatically works of literature and film, but other art forms as well, are about the real world, even if they ask us to imagine it differently from the way it is. I argued in particular that this is the best explanation for the status of what I call the reality assumption. And this is the assumption that everything that is true, everything that is really true, is also storified, where storified just means it obtains in the world of the fiction. And so my idea is that the way that we interpret works of fiction is we start out by assuming that we're in the real world. We assume that everything that's really true is storified, and we adjust this presumption only as needed. And what we're doing when we're imagining the world of the fiction with this background of the real world is we're constructing what psychologists of narrative comprehension call a situation model or a mental model, that is, a representation of the people, places, things, and events that you update as you read. Okay, so that's the basic idea. Now, I say that when we adjust the presumption that everything is really true is true in the fictional world, when we exclude certain things from that domain, we do so in a localized way. So even if a fiction makes it the case that the laws of physics don't apply, we still assume that the rules of psychology, of ordinary psychology, still apply. Okay. And when we retain this presumption, I say we expect a work to be accurate about the relevant facts, that is, the facts that are still within the scope of the reality assumption that haven't been excluded. And that's why I said last time, truth and falsity matter when we're reading fiction. And today what I want to talk about are some of the implications of this view. It'll help, though, to set it up by explaining once again the opposition to the view in order to see why these consequences matter. So the more standard idea is that fictions are in themselves neither true nor false, or at least that we don't care about whether they're true or false, and that they somehow concern alternative realities. Now, theorists who adopt these views can say that we import real-world assumptions into the fiction, but I think the starting point of thinking of ourselves as gripping onto the real world makes a difference when it comes to further aspects of our engagement with fiction. Because if truth and falsity don't matter, and fictions aren't about the real world, I think this renders mysterious, or at least more mysterious than it needs to be, why we care about fictional characters and events, as it's widely agreed that we do, or how we learn from fiction, as again, it's widely agreed that we do. Our emotional engagement with fiction and the influence that fiction has on our lives are surely part of what we care about when we read fiction. It's part of why we read fiction. Okay? And so we do want to explain those things. And what I want to do is say today why I think the reality assumption, this assumption that we start out by assuming everything from the real world is the case in the fiction, helps us to explain these features of our engagement. So the discussion of fiction and emotion within analytic philosophy, in any case, is often focused on what's called the paradox of fiction. I am not going to spend time formulating the paradox in all of its logical glory. There's a lot of different formulations of it, and they don't matter for our present purposes, because what matters is the following puzzle. Ordinarily, in ordinary contexts, in life, or when you're watching the news, or whatever, you respond emotionally only when you have relevant beliefs, right? So if I don't believe you're suffering, I don't pity you. If I don't believe you've done anything to harm me, I'm not angry at you. If I don't believe Santa Claus exists, I don't hope that he'll bring me presents, right? That's just the way that things normally are. Now, if I did, if I were angry at you, even though I knew that you did nothing wrong, for example, if I was afraid of something that I didn't think was dangerous, then I would be in some sense irrational. My responses would not be fitting. I'd be doing something wrong. And this is, for example, how we view phobias. So one way, there's different views of this, but one way of thinking of a phobia is to think that you don't believe something is dangerous, but nonetheless you experience fear. Okay? And sure, that happens, but we don't think phobics are rational. Okay? The puzzle is that in fiction, we don't have the relevant beliefs, right? But we still respond emotionally, and we don't seem to be irrational at all, right? So, you know, in Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad, which is very well known for giving a really stark picture of the suffering of slaves in the American South, we pity the main character, Cora, who's a slave who's trying to escape. We despise Iago in Othello, right? We sympathize with Jean Valjean in Les Misérables. We hope he escapes the clutches of Javert, and so on and so on. We know all these characters don't exist. We know none of this actually happened, and yet we still respond emotionally. And indeed, none of these works would be particularly interesting if you didn't respond emotionally. Okay, so that's the puzzle, right? Why do we do that in fiction? How can we explain it? Well, there's a traditional idea that comes from the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge, according to which we engage in a willing suspension of disbelief. You've probably heard this phrase before. And that idea, at least as others have tried to spell it out, is something like this. We temporarily believe what we're reading. We kind of put aside and forget that it's not true, right? We suspend our disbelief. We believe what we're reading, and that's what enables us to respond emotionally. So at least temporarily, we do that. But by and large, this just does not seem to capture the phenomenon. And indeed, most people who've thought hard about this don't think this is the right approach. We don't seem to believe in fictions even temporarily. That is, we don't forget that we're engaged with a fiction at any time. So an alternative that has been very influential, although not widely agreed with, is presented by the philosopher Kendall Walton, originally in 1978, but then developed in his book, Mimesis's Make-Believe. So Walton argued that our response to fiction is not to suspend disbelief, but rather to engage in a positive cognitive state, okay, which is to make believe or imagine the content of the fiction. And he said that we respond emotionally within the scope of this imaginative project, as it were. Now, the idea that we respond to fiction by imagining, by making believe, is very widely accepted. Okay? But the idea, the consequence that Walton drew from this claim is not at all widely accepted. Walton said, we don't experience genuine fear or pity or despisement or what have you in response to fictions. Okay, rather, we experience something like make-believe fear or imagined pity. Okay. Now, on the face of that, that just seems very implausible. Of course, you know, the emotions seem perfectly real. But Walton is not arguing that the emotions are not real. What he's arguing is that they are not genuine versions of exactly the same kinds of emotions that we experience in ordinary contexts, right? So when we respond with pity to Cora in the Underground Railroad, that's not the same kind of state or process as when we respond with pity to some real person who's suffering, right? So these are different kinds of states, okay? Now, Walton thinks that the states are very similar. They might even feel the same. But the difference is that one occurs within the scope of an imaginative project, and another occurs within the scope of your believing something. And he thinks this makes a significant difference. I think that what Walton is trying to say, in terms that I introduced last time for thinking about imagining, is that our emotions are compartmentalized. They're restricted within the imaginative project so that they don't influence us and motivate our actions in ordinary life. That's, I think, the basic idea that Walton wants to give. Now, I have written a lot about emotions and fiction. I'm not going to get into detail about my views here because that isn't what I wanted to do. Rather, what I want to say is, look, most people don't agree with Walton. I don't agree with Walton either, although not for the reasons most people do, because their reasons are bad. You're just going to have to trust me on that. Okay. Here is why most people disagree with Walton. Okay, the standard view that most people have, is that emotions are neutral between imagining and belief, right? So they deny that the input into the cognitive state, whether it's an imagining or belief, makes any difference, as it were, to our emotion system or affective system, as people put it in the literature, right? Similarly, it doesn't make any difference if something is true or false, right? Merely made up. None of that matters to the emotions, okay? They're the same kind of emotions. But if that's true, right, if it's true that we're just dealing with the same kind of thing, and lots of people have this intuition, right, when they pity a fictional character, it's just the same sort of thing as when they pity a real person, like particularly a real person you've read about, right, might feel the same. Okay. But if that's true, if they are the same kind, this brings us back to the problem of rationality. So we have exactly the same kind of response. But in one case, it would be irrational to respond when you know someone doesn't exist, hasn't suffered, or what have you, right? But in the other case, in the case of fiction, it appears to be perfectly okay, right? So if the two kinds of state are the same, why do we evaluate them differently as far as their rationality? Now, another controversial figure in this debate, Colin Radford, famously argued that in fact these emotions are irrational. Okay. So you think they're rational, but Radford has a series of arguments to say that they're irrational. And before people get upset that Radford is a Philistine, he thinks that they're irrational in one particular way, but that it's completely rational to enjoy fiction and engage in this kind of irrationality because it's a valuable experience. So it's not at all that Radford thinks we shouldn't do it. It's simply that he thinks, you know, here's one more way in which humans are a bit irrational, right? That shouldn't surprise us. Now, why does Radford think that? Well, this is going to be my interpretation of Radford. There's a lot of interpretations of Radford out there. My interpretation, Radford agrees, and in fact, he spends a lot of his article on this topic arguing for the position that the emotions are of the same kind as emotions in other contexts. Okay. And so he thinks, look, if the emotions are of the same kind, then they're subject to the same norms, right? The norms by which we determine whether they're appropriate or inappropriate, rational or irrational. Now, ordinarily, and this is what I think Radford is saying, emotions are governed by a norm we can formulate this way. It is fitting to respond emotionally only if the object of emotion exists. So in normal circumstances, we take emotions to be governed by this norm. Okay. So suppose I think there's a burglar trying to enter my house. Okay. So I'm afraid. Then I realize it's the wind rattling the door. Yeah, in normal circumstances, I stop being afraid. If I persist in being afraid, knowing that there's no burglar, what we have is a knowing violation of this norm. And that's what I think Radford thinks is irrational. We know there's nothing there. We know the emotion is not justified. Okay. So that's irrational. It's irrational in the burglar case. Okay? And Radford just thinks this is our general position with fiction and fictional characters. We know they don't exist, but we still respond emotionally. So it's a knowing violation of this norm. Okay. Now, suppose that we want to disagree with Radford. And I want to disagree with Radford. I don't think we're irrational in responding emotionally to fictional characters. Okay. In that case, what we have to do is say the norms differ, right? Whether or not you think the emotions are the same in the two contexts, let's set that aside and just say, look, in the context of fiction, this norm is clearly suspended. It's perfectly okay to respond emotionally to things that don't exist. But of course, the question then is why? And indeed, part of Radford's article can be thought of as giving reasons why. There's no good answer to the why question. Like, what's the difference? What's the difference between the fiction case that makes it okay and the other cases that it doesn't, right? Why is this norm suspended in response to fiction, but not in the other cases? Now, the standard answer to this question in the literature is very similar to the answer given to Walton. Radford's wrong because truth, in general, but particularly in this case, truth about existence, is irrelevant in the fiction case. Right? So here is a really nice articulation of this point by the philosopher Moon-Young Song. In order to avoid making most fiction-directed emotions unfitting and accordingly inapt and ultimately irrational for this reason, the fittingness of fiction-directed emotions should be understood in terms of fictional truth rather than truth. So the idea then is that if we want to avoid Radford's conclusion, right, we simply substitute what is storified, fictionally true, for what is true. Right? It is storified that Iago, through his machinations, causes Othello to kill Desdemona. It is storified that Cora suffers cruelly at the hands of slave masters. As a result, we respond as you'd expect to what is storified, right? In the usual way. Okay. But I think that there are some serious problems with the substitution approach, some of which are recognized in the literature already, although not articulated in quite the way I'm articulating them. But in any case, I want to now just give you a few reasons to think that this can't be right, that we don't just substitute what's storified for what's true when we engage with fiction. So the first reason concerns what Sean Nichols calls discrepant affect. So these are emotions toward fiction that do not parallel our emotions to real life situations, where what is storified is not what makes the emotion fitting. So I'll give you a few examples, right? At the end of Stanley Kubrick's film Dr. Strangelove, it is storified that the entire world is about to be, and is in the process indeed, of being subject to a nuclear holocaust that will leave almost all human beings as well as everything else dead. Right? And we're watching the nuclear holocaust to the tune of Vera Lynn's We'll Meet Again, which gives you a nice, enjoyable soundtrack to watching the nuclear holocaust. In Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it's storified, this happens within the first chapter, in fact, that the Earth is destroyed by an alien wrecking crew, leaving exactly two human beings left in the entire universe, the ones who happen to not be on the Earth at that particular moment. In Monty Python and the Holy Grail, a killer rabbit massacres half of the Round Table Knights. Right? I'm sure you're all depressed. Okay. Now, within these stories, like within the world of the story from the perspective of the fictional characters inside the story, these are all gruesome and tragic events. But we laugh, right? We're amused by these events. I take it that we would not be amused by a nuclear holocaust, right? I mean, we'd find the idea of a killer rabbit quite amusing, but if there really were a killer rabbit, you know, with big teeth, then who knows what we'd say. Now, there are other cases, like dark comedies are the classic example here, but there are other cases. We sympathize with Humbert Humbert as he tries to seduce Lolita, right? We feel a little bit uncomfortable about it, but we do it anyway, right? Most readers, for example, aren't particularly upset when the mother dies and Humbert Humbert achieves his goal, for example. We root for Tony Soprano, right, who is a sadistic murderer, as if you step back and think about what he does. Now, normally, we don't respond this way to pedophiles and murderers, okay, I hope. Okay. But we do in fiction. And these emotions are the ones that are invited by these fictions. They're appropriate in at least some sense. Okay, so that's one reason to think we don't, that what's storified doesn't just take the place of what's true. Okay. But further, I think, even when we are focused on what's storified, right, even when what's storified is playing its usual role, what's true still plays a role. What's true still matters. I'll give you two kinds of cases that I think demonstrate the importance of truth. So the first one concerns the intensity of emotions. Okay. So this is the following is just widely accepted. Emotions vary in intensity. So there are things that merit mild annoyance, like my bus is 3 minutes late, right? Which do not merit boiling rage. Okay. So that would be unfitting, and an unfitting response to the fact that your bus is 3 minutes late is to, you know, throw a tantrum and become violent, for example. Right? The sudden tragic death of a close friend, at least in ordinary circumstances, other things being equal, right, warrants more intense grief than the death of a complete stranger. Right, so this is just fairly straightforward. And this kind of intensity is subject to evaluation. We think there's something wrong with the person who gets into a tantrum over their bus being late by a few minutes and so on. Now, it's well known that attending to fictionality reduces intensity. So the classic way to be less afraid when you're watching a horror film is to remind yourself that it's only fiction, right? And you can do this in general if you get emotionally involved. And indeed, this is the key to Bertolt Brecht's entire approach, which is to make it clear that what he's dealing with is fictional, so that you don't get emotionally involved and you remain rational in response to what he's doing. Okay. Now, what matters to present purposes is that this is how it should be, right? Other things being equal, you should respond with less intensity to what's happening in a fiction than you would respond to the same kinds of real events portrayed in the same way. Okay? So what I'm saying is not that you should respond with equal sadness to a very dry statistical report. Nobody does that. I mean, we probably should, but we don't. But if you are reading about a real person who suffered the kind of things that Cora suffers in the Underground Railroad, right? All things being equal, your response should be more intense in normal circumstances. So if you consider, for example, just to give an example of this, the kind of case where, say, someone has read Anna Karenina, and spoiler alert, she commits suicide at the end, sorry. And this person is absolutely awash in grief, you know, for months, okay, there's something wrong, right? And how do you explain that there's something wrong? You say to them, it's only fiction, she didn't exist. I mean, get over it, right? Okay, so it looks like there's a difference in intensity in general, right, that's rational in response to fictions. And when we say, look, it doesn't matter, they don't exist, the point is that that's reminding someone of what's true, right? The lowered intensity in response to fiction doesn't concern what's storified, right? Storified that Anna's death is tragic and terrible. Okay. What it concerns is what's true, what you actually know about the real world. So the intensity of these emotions is generally lower and of lesser duration. For example, you can close the book and move on with your lives, no matter what happened inside the fiction. Okay. Because of what's true, not because of what's storified. We don't forget. Okay. So, again, because in reality, the characters don't exist and the events never happened. The second case that I think exemplifies the fact that truth matters to these responses are cases in which we resist responding emotionally in the way that a fiction asks us to do. So in Gone with the Wind, it is storified that the slave character, Prissy, is stupid and deceptive and hysterical, right? In Dickens's Oliver Twist, it's storified that Fagin is a cruel, conniving fence for stolen goods who beats his young orphans on a regular basis. The fictions in question invite us to laugh contemptuously at Prissy and to despise Fagin. But as is well known, right, these fictions presuppose racist and anti-Semitic stereotypes, which the authors of the relevant fiction took for granted, apply to real people in these groups. Okay. And we're likely to find these portrayals in various ways cringeworthy, okay, and disturbing, and we might not wish to go along. Okay. You can go along, you can bracket what you know if you want to, but if you have the response of initial resistance to going along with feeling this way about these characters, it's probably because you reject the presupposition that these invited responses would be fitting in response to the actual people, right, that belong to the same groups. Now, if it's the case that we doubt the aptness or the fittingness of sneering at Prissy or despising Fagin, again, the concern is with what's true and not with what's storified. Because according to what's storified, they certainly merit those responses. It's only because we recognize what's being presupposed from the real world that we resist. Okay. So, to sum up, the standard approach I've been criticizing has it that when we respond emotionally to fictional characters and events, we simply set aside what's true, we substitute it for what is with what is storified. Now, if we reject this approach, how do we explain the facts about our emotional engagement with fiction? Right? How do we explain that we're still rational? This was part of the point of adopting this approach. And my answer is that we should actually start from the other side of the spectrum and make the opposite assumption. Right? Start from the reality assumption. Start from the truth. Right? Again, assume that everything true is storified and adjust this presumption only when needed. And I'm just going to sketch how I think we respond. We can explain our emotional responses in these terms. So the idea is, look, given the reality assumption, our default way of responding is just to respond in ways that parallel emotions and other contexts, because we're taking for granted that characters are human beings. When they're represented as suffering, they experience the kind of pain and anguish that we experience, right? So in the Underground Railroad, Colson Whitehead invents a great deal. For example, he imagines the Underground Railroad as a literal railroad, when in fact it's just a metaphor for escape routes that slaves took. But the horrors of slavery in the novel, very significantly, because this is the point of the novel, remain within the scope of the reality assumption. So we take the suffering that Cora experiences to be the kind of suffering that real people experience, and we respond with that kind of horror and pity. When we adjust the presumption to exclude certain domains of fact, our emotions sensitive to those domains are adjusted accordingly. So in particular, most works of fiction, nearly all, not all, include invented individuals and events. Right? We recognize that the facts about who exists and exactly what happened to them are excluded from the scope of the reality assumption. Those are aspects that are made up. And we set aside our expectations of accuracy in those respects. Because we expect, right, because we don't think that Cora's existence falls within the scope of the reality assumption, we simply set that aside when we respond emotionally. That's the idea. Okay. And so that is why non-existence doesn't prevent emotional responses, right? It's outside the reality assumption. It doesn't prevent them, it doesn't make them unfitting. When we have greater departures from reality, right, that will change the fitting condition considerations further, because our expectations of accuracy will be less for more aspects of the fiction. And that explains why it's not appropriate to respond in the ways, that explains why it isn't inappropriate, excuse me, to respond in the ways that we do to dark comedies or cases of discrepant affect. We don't treat the events as falling within the scope of the reality assumption, right? Kubrick is giving us a kind of absurdist warning about possibilities, right? Based on a book, as it happens, that's much more serious, the book Failsafe, of which another movie was made called Failsafe, which is completely serious. Okay? And Kubrick takes the same events and makes them into this dark comedy, which is supposed to be, in some respects, terrifying, but in other respects, highlighting the absurdity of things and therefore amusing. But we don't treat those events, we don't treat the nuclear holocaust as falling within the scope of the reality assumption. We don't treat what happens with the killer rabbit, obviously, right, as falling within the scope of the reality assumption, and therefore we're free to enjoy the way they're presented and be amused at them. Right? It matters a great deal that the individuals don't exist and that the events didn't happen. When you present, you can present real events, real tragic events, in a funny frame. But our responses tend to be, at best, mixed. So for people who are familiar with the Darwin Awards, there are many books on the Darwin Awards, and you can look them up online. The Darwin Awards are funny stories about people who died doing stupid things. I'll let you think about the connection to Darwin on your own. And the stories are funny, but they're that much less funny than they would be if it weren't the case that someone has actually died, I take it. Okay. When it comes to these kinds of emotions, in response to these kinds of cases. The emotions remain compartmentalized, right? The laughter at the nuclear holocaust or the sympathy with Humbert Humbert don't escape into our ordinary lives and influence our responses to real nuclear threats or real pedophiles. Okay, that's the idea. Now, on the other side of the coin, when we take representations in a fiction to fall within the scope of the reality assumption, we retain our expectations of accuracy, and that's why what explains the cases in which we resist responding as invited. Right? So, as I mentioned last week, we ordinarily take fictional characters, although they don't exist, to belong to types of people, and we retain our expectations of accuracy concerning types of people. So even if Prissy and Fagin don't exist, we expect the authors to be accurate with respect to the types of people to which they belong and who they're explicitly identified with. Consequently, we take ordinary norms of fittingness to apply. The authors violate our expectations of accuracy, and as a result, we think that if we were to respond emotionally in that way, we would be violating the norm. And the resistance, I think, shows that there's something at stake here about how we think about the world and how we respond to the world, and not simply how we respond to the fiction. And this is, I want to say, the same grounding in reality that explains how we learn from fiction. Okay, and so that's the subject I'll turn to next. Okay. So it's widely agreed we can learn from fiction. Some people, unsurprisingly philosophers who like to deny anything that other people think, have denied this, but I'm going to set that aside here because most people would agree that we learn from fiction, and that at least some works of fiction are, as we say, cognitively valuable. Okay. So if this is true, the question is, what kind or kinds of cognitive value do works of fiction possess? Now, there's a vast philosophical literature on this question, which I won't even attempt to exhaust here. But among the sorts of things that people say, not just philosophers, but other scholars and people in ordinary life, you can find this stuff in magazines and newspapers and so on, are things like reading great works of literature deepens our understanding, broadens our horizon, tells us something about what it's like to have other kinds of experiences, maybe experiences we ourselves will never be able to have. They enhance empathy, cultivate moral perception, exercise imaginative skills, give us modal knowledge. Okay, these are just among the kinds of cognitive value that have been discussed in the literature. Now, I'll just mention as an aside that recently psychologists have gotten into this game and have tried to test what we do learn from fiction. In particular, some psychologists have claimed that reading fiction enhances empathy, improves our understanding of other people, that's theory of mind for people who are into that kind of thing, or reduces prejudice. Okay, and I don't know if you've seen, I don't know what has happened in France with respect to the headlines, but there were headlines when some of these studies come out. We get headlines, and there's a headline on the BBC about how, you know, psychologists have proven that fiction makes us better people. Right? Because I'm sure you all know that literature professors are the most moral people. So this is the there's a big literature now empirically, something that I work on as well. But I'm going to set that aside because my interest here is not on whether we do learn from fiction in these ways, but rather on what is required if we are going to learn from fiction in these ways. So let's just assume we do sometimes learn from fiction in these ways and ask, what are the conditions to make that possible? Now, one topic that is very rarely discussed in the philosophical literature, at least until very recently, is the way we learn ordinary facts from fiction, like facts about geography or history. Now, this is not because people deny that we learn facts from fiction. In fact, a lot of articles on this subject start out by saying, yes, yes, we learn facts from fiction, but that's not interesting. I want to focus on this other thing. And what's the reason for this neglect? I think there are two assumptions that people make. The first is that our aim, as philosophers say, is to identify cognitive values that are unique to fiction and contribute to its value as fiction, right? To explain why we care about fiction specifically. And it looks like learning ordinary facts can't do that job because it's obviously within the remit of many works of nonfiction to convey information about ordinary works of fact. That's kind of how people mostly think about nonfiction. Okay. The second assumption is that the capacity to convey ordinary facts is too trivial an achievement to constitute a special value of fiction. Something like accumulating a list of factoids in your belief box, as it's sometimes colorfully put. So just to give you an example of the way people think about this process as relatively trivial, here's an example from Anna Echino and Greg Curry, and this comes from Anna Karenina. Anna looked out of the window and saw Alexei ringing the front doorbell. And Echino and Curry point out that from this sentence, you can infer, in case you were wondering, that in 19th century Russia, there were doorbells. Right. Okay. And surely, whatever the great value of fiction is, it doesn't rest on the fact that you can pick up information like this. And this is the sort of case that gets discussed in the literature. Now, I think both of these assumptions are wrong. So let me just say why briefly before I move on. So first, I don't think there are any cognitive values specific to fiction, okay, or specific to nonfiction, because fiction and nonfiction, in my view, aren't distinguished by essential characteristics, including epistemic characteristics. Now, I do think there are cognitive values that might be more closely associated with fiction in virtue of features that are more common in fiction, right? And I'll talk about that in a little bit. The second assumption is just mistaken about how we learn facts from fiction, right? It's not at all a trivial achievement. And so I want to say something about that. And my reason for doing this is not just to say something about learning facts and why I think it's interesting, but also to say that that is something we need to understand and need in order to understand the other cognitive values that are ordinarily attributed to fiction. So when we learn from a narrative, especially a long, complex narrative like a novel, we must first comprehend what we're reading. Okay? That's pretty straightforward, right? So here's a passage from Min Jin Lee's novel Pachinko, which relates the story of several generations of a Korean family living in Japan. And the passage takes place in 1933 in Osaka. Yoseb was an easy talker by nature, and though his Japanese was better than proficient, his accent never failed to give him away. From appearances alone, he could approach any Japanese and receive a polite smile. But he'd lose the welcome as soon as he said anything. He was a Korean, after all, and no matter how appealing his personality, unfortunately, he belonged to a cunning and wily tribe. Okay. Now, I take it that from this passage, a competent reader can learn at least the following two facts. Some ethnic Koreans are visually indistinguishable from the Japanese. And in 1933, the Japanese held certain negative stereotypes about Koreans. But I don't think that these facts should be treated as isolated truths, bits of information that we collect. Okay. Rather, when we understand a narrative, we construct a situation model. We construct a multidimensional mental representation of the individuals, the settings, the events that unfold, which, as I've said, gets called situation model or mental model. In the case of Lee's novel, this is a complex picture of life for the Korean characters, the generations of Koreans who are living in Japan. And we get this through the interlocking stories of the different characters over time, constructed by importing information that we know about the world and about the situation, and our knowledge of the genre conventions and so on. So for example, later in the novel, Yoseb's nephew, Noah, right, this is the next generation, hides his identity, right? He's grown up in Japan, he can speak Japanese like a Japanese. He hides his identity and passes for Japanese, and you understand what's going on because you remember what happened with people like Yosef. So the passage isn't giving us isolated facts, right? It's giving us a picture, a big picture of what's going on. Now, to learn from the novel, of course, it's not enough to just comprehend what's going on in the novel. We must export some of the information, like the two facts that I mentioned, into our representations of how the world really is. Okay? But this is not just exporting individual representations. This is abstracting away from the specifics of the fictional characters and taking that picture that you've developed of what Korean life was like in Japan, right, and adding it to our mental representations of the world. And I think our mental representations of the world are not just a list of beliefs, but a complex mental representation of the individuals and events and situations. They're in the form of mental models as well. Okay. So what do we export when we export from this picture that we develop in reading? What we export is what we take to be within the scope of the reality assumption. So we know that Yoseb and Noah don't exist. So we don't export beliefs that are specifically about Yoseb and Noah. We do think, however, the novel gives an accurate picture of what happened to Koreans over this period in Japan. Indeed, that's the purpose of the novel. Okay. And that's the information we export. Okay. So to do this well, you have to be sensitive to what falls within and without the scope of the reality assumption, which isn't always easy. It's pretty straightforward in Pachinko. It's not always easy in other works. I think, ultimately, this way of thinking about things gives us a certain kind of default justification for the beliefs that we form. I'm not going to get into that. For now, I just want to say this is how I think we learn facts from fiction. Now, one conclusion you can draw from this is that learning facts from fiction is not trivial. Right? And that's because it relies on understanding. So understanding in the discussion in epistemology is generally distinguished from just propositional knowledge, knowing that such and such is the case. We don't just understand that or why something happened. Right? We have what's called objectual understanding. We understand a phenomenon, like understanding photosynthesis or understanding the Korean experience in Japan. And when we have this kind of understanding, we don't just have a list of truths, we understand how the truths relate to each other. We're able to apply them in new situations. We're able to make inferences from them about other things. Okay? That's what understanding consists in. And understanding is typically considered an achievement. So if learning facts from fiction involves understanding, then it is also an achievement. But further, I want to say that the model of learning facts that I've just given is essential to explaining other cognitive values typically attributed to fiction. Okay. And the interesting thing is, because people are identifying these other cognitive values as somehow special to fiction, they tend to think they have nothing to do with truth. So they have nothing to do with facts and learning facts. Right? And I think that's just wrong. Okay, so I want to motivate that claim. Okay. Now, many of the cognitive values that are attributed to fiction are forms of understanding, which I mean forms of understanding the world around us. And as I said, these forms of understanding are typically distinguished from learning truths. So the idea here is that even if it's true that learning facts relies on understanding, the converse doesn't hold. Understanding can occur without a reliance on facts. So for example, some say that rather than gaining new beliefs when we engage with fiction, we come to understand the significance of the beliefs that we hold. We come to think about how they apply in particular situations. Others propose that what we come to understand is at a far more abstract level than ordinary empirical facts. Right? Great works of fiction, it is often held, give us insight into moral psychology, right? The motivations behind human behavior. The philosophers Oliver Connolly and Bashar Haider put it this way, that fictions give us understanding of the inner life, character, conditions for happiness, and the moral dimension that attends any serious consideration of human possibilities. And another popular idea is that engaging with fiction gives us insight into other people's experiences and perspectives. So we come away with insight into what it's like for them, what it was like for them to live the lives they lead, to feel the way that they felt, and so on. As the psychologists Raymond Marr and Keith Oatley put it, the imaginative simulations prompted by fiction enable the understanding of minds that would otherwise be opaque. Okay. Those are real minds that we come to understand. So let's suppose that we do gain these kinds of understanding by reading fiction. Right? It doesn't follow that accuracy with respect to the facts is irrelevant, even if the relevant facts are more abstract or significant than, say, basic facts about doorbells or what have you. Right, so consider the first kind of case, the example of moral psychology. Now, I think we acquire insight into moral psychology in just the same way as we acquire understanding and knowledge of facts. In fact, I don't think it's actually any different. So specifically, I would say, we construct a situation model of the world of the story. We selectively export representations. But what we selectively export from the situation model are fairly abstract claims. For example, models of the interrelationships between thoughts and feelings and human behaviors and motivations and moral considerations, rather than more specific facts about history or geography or what have you. Now, if that's right, we should expect that fictions will be better sources of this kind of insight the more accurate they are about these relevant general facts. And I just want to give an example that tries to motivate that claim that accuracy matters. Okay, so consider a case study. There's a debate in psychology about the relevance of what's called character, not fictional character, but personality traits in this case, and situations. So on one side, you have a traditional idea that fictions offer insight into the way that people's stable character traits, like dispositions to be generous or selfish, courageous or cowardly, right? Dispositions that are typically and traditionally associated with virtues and vices, are what motivate human behavior. And I think that there's no doubt that many works of fiction do rely on this sense of character, right? In Tom Jones, you get characters like Squire Allworthy, right, and Mr. Square, who all live up or down to their names. Balzac's La Comédie Humaine is full of characters who represent specific kinds of types that are supposed to explain why they act in the way that they do. Okay. The worry, though, is that there are many results in social psychology that put pressure on the idea that stable personality traits explain our behavior at all. Right? It seems like people respond much more strongly to the situations they are in, right? And this has caused situationist psychologists to argue not only that stable personality traits are irrelevant, right, but that they probably don't exist at all. So the point that I want to make, right, is that if the situationists are right and we don't have stable character traits that explain our behavior, then fictions that represent behaviors flowing from stable character traits are inaccurate with this in this respect, with respect to human psychology. And so you don't acquire understanding of human psychology from fictions of that kind. Now, I'm not claiming the situationists are right, right? This is very controversial, and there's a lot of really interesting work on how to save the idea that there are personality traits. What matters is that whatever the right psychological account turns out to be, it's only the fictions that are in accord with it that are the ones that are giving you genuine insight into moral psychology. Okay, so let me turn to a second one of these cognitive values, the value of learning what it's like to undergo certain experiences. I call this experiential understanding. And I want to start with a nonfiction example. Okay, this is Maya Angelou's memoir, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sing. This is the first of a series of memoirs. This one addresses her childhood. Okay, now, reading Angelou's memoir seems to be a very good way of finding out what it was like for her to grow up in the segregated American South as a black girl. Okay. And this is the sense that you get this knowledge of what it's like, this understanding of what it's like. Comes from the fact that Angelou's writing is evocative and vivid. It prompts imagery, it prompts emotion, right? We visualize the scenes, we respond, often responding in the way that the young Maya does, often responding in different ways, as it were, seeing her from other points of view. And these experiential dimensions are then part of the situation model that we construct, okay? And part of the representations that we export from the memoir. So we don't just learn, right? Let's assume we take Maya Angelou's memoir to be fully accurate. We can just take the entire situation model, put it in our beliefs, right? We don't just learn what happened to her. We learn how it felt, right? And we do this in a kind of experiential way. Now, I take it, right, that it would be hopeless to claim that by reading the novel, I now know what it was like for Maya Angelou to experience what she experienced. This is related to Margarita Arcangeli's talk last week, actually, right? But it does seem plausible that I know more, right? Understand a bit more about what it was like for her than had I not read the memoir, right? I think that is definitely plausible. But of course, for this to be genuinely the case, for it not to be just the case that I have this impression, but I'm completely mistaken, okay? It must be that my affective and imagistic experience simulates, or in Susan Fagan's words, qualitatively approximates, at least to some degree, the original experience, right? I don't know if it does, but that's what has to be happening here. But notice that in reading this memoir, the understanding of what it's like that I acquire is not limited to the experience of one individual, Maya Angelou. Right? Angelou's purpose in these memoirs is not simply to tell people what happened to her and how it felt, but to give a larger truth about the lives of Black women in America. Right? That was her explicit purpose. So plausibly, readers of I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings acquire some understanding as well as what it was like for young Black girls in general during this period, right? Or even more generally, something about what it was like, what it is like for anyone who's coped with extreme prejudice or extreme poverty or who was separated from their parents, which all might be experiences that each of us hasn't necessarily had. And we do that by abstracting away from the details that are specific to Angelou, right? And selectively exporting from the situation model those representations that apply more generally, right? And I think that's exactly what's going on when we learn what it's like from fiction, right? This abstraction process is what explains it, okay? So Dickens, right, he doesn't tell us what it was like for Oliver Twist to be an orphan in Victorian London, because there is no Oliver Twist. There's nothing it was like for Oliver Twist to be an orphan in Victorian London. But it doesn't mean that he can't provide insight into what it was like for orphans, or the poor more generally, in Victorian London, right? Similarly, through the fictional characters Gilbert and Hortense Joseph, Andrea Levy's novel, Small Island, plunges us into the experience of Jamaican immigrants in Britain after the Second World War. Okay. Now, that gives us a sense of something that goes beyond the particular fictional characters. And in each case, we might abstract away even further to get a sense of what it was like for immigrants or the poor more generally, wherever they might be and whenever, right? But notice that with either fiction or nonfiction, a good portion of learning what it's like involves learning ordinary facts, right? Unless you're already very well informed concerning the experience of young Black girls in the segregated American South, or orphans in Victorian London, right, or Jamaican immigrants in Britain after the Second World War, you're going to be picking up a lot of facts, and that's going to be part of your sense of what it was like. If it turned out that Angelou's memoir was a fraud, that none of this had happened to her, there are many memoirs that are frauds in this way, right? Or if it turned out that conditions for Victorian orphans were actually a lot better than Dickens portrayed, or that Jamaican immigrants in Britain didn't really experience as much racism as Levy makes it seem, right? Then we would be unlikely to say that we had learned what it was like by reading these novels, right? So there has to be a basis in fact about these aspects, even when we're dealing with these non-existent individuals. Now, if understanding in the senses that I've described relies on accuracy about certain facts, this raises an obvious question. Why does fiction seem like such a good way to acquire it? Right? Shouldn't it be the case that nonfiction would be a better way to acquire it, since fictions, after all, have a lot of invention, right? And if things rely on being accurate, that just looks like it's a little bit confusing. But that just doesn't seem right. And I think the reason is that there are standard features of fiction that are associated with increased comprehension. And this is provably the case in studies of reading by psychologists. So first and foremost is the fact that works of fiction are typically narrative. Not all works of fiction are narrative, but most are narrative. And people grasp information better in narrative form than they do in other structures. So this has been shown many times. If you want to teach someone something, tell them a story. In addition, fictions typically prompt imagery, They offer inside views, not all of them, but some do offer inside views of the thoughts and feelings of characters. They're often read for entertainment rather than study, which tends to increase interest and absorption of information. So again, you want something to learn something, don't tell them that's what you want them to do. Just give them a story. Okay. Now, none of these features is exclusive to fiction. The Angelou memoir is a good example, right, a work of nonfiction that has many of these features in abundance. Nonetheless, one standard feature of fiction less associated with nonfiction is obviously invention, making things up. And there are good reasons to think that some degree of invention can enhance the features that improve understanding. So, in particular, the author John Berendt calls this rounding the corners to make a better narrative. You shift things around to make the story more coherent in a way that people understand it better. But of course, invention and distortion can have an even more powerful role in comprehension. Some have argued that invention and distortion are necessary for some forms of understanding. Like Catherine Elgin argues that the knowledge that we get through scientific models, the understanding we get through scientific models, relies essentially on the fact that scientific models simplify and abstract away from the reality. Right? So it's not a defect of the ideal gas law, for example, that ignores the fact that there are interactions between molecules. That's because abstracting away from some properties helps clarify others. And I think that is what happens with fiction. It simplifies and abstracts. Nonetheless, fictions, just like scientific models, must accurately represent some features of the target phenomena, or we wouldn't account as understanding those features at all. We have to be able to abstract away from what's invented and apply what we understand to what's true. Okay, so very quickly, I want to bring these two themes together and talk about a kind of learning that's not a kind of understanding, but a more practical kind of learning. A number of philosophers have said that fictions improve our cognitive capacities in a variety of ways. I want to focus on the idea that fictions are emotionally educational. Okay? As Jennifer Robinson describes, they give us a sentimental education. Appealing here to Rousseau. Okay. So there's very many versions of this idea. The idea that reading fictions makes us more empathetic to people who are oppressed or trains us to respond appropriately in different circumstances in ordinary life, like, for example, to respond with compassion when it's appropriate. Now, I take it that any influence that reading fiction has on our emotions toward real-world targets counts as a cognitive improvement, counts as learning in the relevant sense, only if the emotions are fitting, right? Only if compassion is deserved by its object, right? Is it the appropriate response? But as we have seen, for an emotion to be fitting requires accuracy with respect to features relevant to the emotion. So, for example, in the Underground Railroad, it's because Whitehead accurately represents the horrors of slavery that carrying over, exporting this emotion to real slaves, to realizing what they suffered and feeling increased pity for them that you might not have vividly felt before, right? That's appropriate. That could be a kind of learning, but only because Whitehead is accurate with respect to what happens. So I think, again, learning in this way requires the same kind of selective export, or as I call it, carryover of emotions, right? Now with emotions rather than other kinds of representations. In order to learn in this way, we must keep some of our emotions compartmentalized, right? Emotions toward Cora that are specific to Cora, for example, because we know she doesn't exist. But when the emotions are responses to aspects of the story that are within the scope of the reality assumption, that's when we can allow them to be carried over and influence us in our lives. Right? Contrast that with the case of discrepant affect. I take it we do not learn to fear rabbits by watching Monty Python. We don't learn to sympathize with pedophiles by reading Lolita. We don't learn to treat nuclear holocausts as a cause for amusement. Why not? Well, because we compartmentalize emotions toward these aspects of the story world, the ones that are outside the scope of the reality assumption. Right? And we carry over our emotions where the reality assumption applies, and that's what constitutes this kind of learning. I'm almost done. I know I'm a little over. OK, Okay, so this is just to generalize. I've discussed only a handful of different kinds of learning from fiction, but I think the points I've made generalize to others, at least where the cognitive values associated with fiction are directed toward the real world. Right? This shouldn't be a surprise. The idea that reading fiction makes us in some sense better, improves us, is the idea that it improves our understanding of other real people, our understanding of real aspects of the world, enabling us to function better in this world. That's the whole point. Okay? And where this is the case, what I've argued is that accuracy concerning relevant facts will always be required, right? And learning will involve selective export in line with the reality assumption. Now, I should say as a caveat that there can be other cognitive values associated with fiction, right, that seem less tied to truth, like improving our general cognitive skills or generating modal or conceptual knowledge, knowledge of possibilities. And I'm just going to set this aside here, although I'm skeptical that these really escape the net of truth either. So just to conclude, say one reason we read fiction is because we care about the characters and events, and that's indicated by emotional involvement. We see in these characters and their experiences reflections of ourselves and the world around us and other people, right? And this is also the reason that we treat fictions as cognitively valuable, right? They tell us something about our world and how to function in it. Invention and imagination contribute to these values, but only when they're directed at the real world and only when there's a bedrock of fact, right? So we cannot escape the view that fictions concern the real world, as I've said. Thank you.